On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Curtis, Brian, and I talk with Richard Black, CEO of Secure Channels, about enhancing your data protection, adopting encryption and authentication, and a bunch more. Plus, we talk about how the government shut down and how it's affecting the IT side of things. It's time for GDPR in the United States. Well, we'll talk about that as well. Come by and listen and more here on Twiet. Twiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twiet. This is Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 325, recorded January 18th, 2019. Securing data with Secure Channels. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by LastPass. Make password management a priority in 2019. Secure every password-protected entry point to your business and reduce the threat of a breach at lastpass.com/twit. And by Slack. Slack is a collaboration hub for your work that makes sure the right people in your team are always in the loop and key information is always at your fingertips. Learn more at slack.com. Welcome to Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big world of the enterprise, but I definitely can't guide you by myself. I am joined by not one, but two enterprise juggernauts in the industry, starting with Mr. Brian Chi, Director, Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu. Chibert, how are you, my friend? Any new toys to show us today?
I'm a little sore. I went stomping around at Lions Arboretum, climbing up and down river stream beds and so forth. We are actually going to take a real hard look at using a new, well, relatively new device from Transition Networks. It allows me to run PoE Plus over coaxial cable. So I'm looking at being able to do nearly, a reasonable amount of PoE, enough to run a small access Wi-Fi access point. Out at 1,000 meters of coax. So on distances that I would normally have to use fiber optics, I can now provide power, especially in an area where there's so much tree coverage, photovoltaics aren't going to work for me. So ought to be interesting.
That's cool. It's cool. Hopefully it'll be affordable because I want to take advantage of some of that as well.
Actually, I just found out they're like $360 a pair.
Okay. Well, we'll see. We'll see if that's in the budget. Well, of course, we love having our favorite journalist on as well, Mr. Curtis Franklin, Senior Editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, what's cooking for this week?
Well, this week, the nice criminals who managed to take much of the holiday season off are back at work, so that's giving me plenty to write about. I got some great stuff happening over at Dark Reading, and my inbox is starting to fill up with invitations for the RSA conference that I'll be attending just a little bit later this year. So exciting times and keeps me indoors and happy through this bitter chill of a Central Florida winter.
Well, thanks, guys, for being here. We have a pretty jam-packed episode of data security. We're going to get into it a bit. And as well as we're going to talk a little bit about how the IT industry is being affected by the shutdown. Plus, our guest from Secure Channel will talk about data protection, encryption adoption, authentication, and more. But before we do all that, like we always do, let's go ahead and jump into this week's blips. Now, security breaches are a weekly thing for us now, so it wouldn't be a week without us reporting on one. This one is coming from a security researcher firm, UpGuard Cybersecurity Researchers. They have reported that the existence of a server that has been exposed to the public that contains terabytes of confidential government data relating to the FBI investigations. Now, who did the server belong to? Well, it belonged to the Oklahoma Department of Securities, or ODS, which is actually a government agency that deals with securities security cases and complaints. Now, the database was discovered by the Shodan search engine, dating the public nature of the server back to the November 30th date of last year. Now, even though UpGuard made the ODS aware of the public server on December 7th, it was actually out there publicly for over a week. Now, in fact, UpGuard was able to download the database during that time and see data on cases dating back all the way to 1986. Now, they found that there was 3 terabytes of information representing millions of files, including personal data to system credentials, internal communication records, and even more. It even stored information such as a spreadsheet of IT credentials for accounts with THWART, Semantic Protection Suite, Tivoli, and others, a Blue Express database of account details for third parties submitting security filings, credentials required for remote access to ODS workstations, training documents, email histories, and files relating to investigations. Now, how did this happen, you may want to ask? Well, the reason for the exposure was due to an unsecured rsync service at an IP address registered to the Oklahoma Office of Management Enterprise Services, allowing any user from any IP address to download all the files stored on the server. Now, there hasn't been much response from the ODS just yet, but they're exploring remedial actions and notifications for anyone whose information may have been exposed. Now, I have a feeling this is just the beginning of the data breaches we're about to hear in 2019. What do you think, Curtis?
I think more data breaches are about as certain as more sunrises in 2019. So just to remind us that this has been going on for a while, a new data dump has leaked hundreds of millions of accounts. A folder called Collection Number 1 with over 12,000 files containing nearly 773 million email addresses and over 21 million unique passwords from numerous previous data breaches, some potentially dating back as far as 2008, has been posted online in another massive leak of credential data. Some 140 million email addresses and about half of the just leaked passwords are new, meaning the data has not been previously published on Have I Been Pwned or any of the compromised password sites. The folder contained data from what appears to be over 2,000 previously breached and dehashed databases. The data appears to be from breaches between 2008 and 2015, but it's possible that at least some of this leaked data was not involved in a data breach at all, according to the researchers who found it. Now, the file has since been removed, but according to the researchers, the data is now being advertised for sale in a popular hacker forum. Security researcher Troy Hunt has uploaded the file to his Have I Been Pwned service, where individuals can verify if their email addresses are on the list. And we urge you to head over there just to be sure.
You know, there's a really good reason why your new smart TV was so affordable. It's collecting and selling your data. Little did you know that your smart TV is sharing your viewing habits to subsidize that super cheap monster TV. Well, that's what Business Insider is claiming. But sadly, this article kind of throws a statement out there that you've unwittingly joined a Nielsen-like rating family, but doesn't seem to back any of these claims up. I've suspected this for a long time, but so far, no one has offered up any hard proof yet.
Has your organization moved a business-critical system to the cloud yet? Well, there's a new report from the Cloud Security Alliance telling us that organizations are moving business-critical systems to the cloud very quickly. Now, according to them, nearly 69% of enterprises are moving business critical applications to the cloud. 70% of those are actually using migrating data for ERP applications or enterprise resource planning. Now, this one hits home to me because I worked for Dynamics GP and AX for almost a decade, but 90% of those are actually using either SAP, Oracle, or Microsoft Dynamics. Now, these numbers don't come without concern, though. According to the report, the concerns among some of these organizations, including or migrating sensitive data, which is 65% of them, security, compliance challenges, disruption of business operations, and time to migrate. Now, more than half of the people who responded expect that there will be security incidents in the cloud and that they will increase from this year. So there are actually concerns with that as well. And because of these concerns, organizations are having to take additional steps to ensure compliance during data migration to the new cloud servers, which is adding 5 times more to the implementation costs. Now, there is an upside to this. The data is showing that once organizations have moved securely, they can now take advantage of some of the new features being in the cloud, such as scalability with new technologies, lower cost of ownership, security patching, and updating from the provider. Now, I smell some new startups this year that can ensure for easier, more secure data migrations. You might want to take that as your next venture.
Well, speaking of new, we've now got known vulnerabilities and exploits in building control systems. Researchers who discovered multiple vulnerabilities in building automation systems, or BAS equipment, have also constructed proof-of-concept malware to exploit some of those security weaknesses. Security researcher Eliza Constante and her team at Forescout created the test malware, a modular design that includes a worm that spreads itself among BAS devices, last summer using intelligence they gathered over the past 3 years while testing these popular BAS systems. The systems included things like protocol gateways and PLCs for HVAC and access control. All of that, they were testing them for vulnerabilities. Now, during this period, they uncovered 10 major security flaws, half of which were cross-site scripting bugs in their associated web application interfaces, as well as privilege escalation and buffer overflow vulnerabilities. Constante shared the team's research at S4X19 this week, a conference down in Miami. While the affected BAS vendors, which Forescout declined to reveal, have since patched the vulnerabilities, more than 11,000 of the affected devices today remain exposed on the public internet to buffer overflow flaws, mostly in schools and hospitals. Why? Well, due to poor patching processes or non-existent patching processes. Forescout spent a total of $12,000 on the malware and equipment for the project, which Constante said demonstrates that BAS hacking doesn't require heavily resourced nation-state backing. Meanwhile, some building management operations are beginning to find the cybersecurity religion. David Weinstein, Vice President of Threat Research at Clarity, said his company is seeing major real estate firms finally beginning to inquire about securing their properties, building automation systems, and, well, it's just in time.
Well, our friends at Toshiba Memory America unveiled a 1 terabyte single package PCIe Gen 3 X4L SSDs with 96-layer 3D flash memory. Wow. Okay, this is a press release. It is from CES 2019. And basically, they will introduce in the fourth quarter of its single package ball grid array BGA solid state drive product line, the BG4 series. Toshiba's memory's new lineup of ultra-compact NVMe SSDs place both the flash and all-new controller into one package. Anyway, so it's a press release. And realistically, this is a new trend. I'm going to riff here a little bit. The NVMe package is making a really, really, really big inroad into the server market. You know, having your primary, your boot, your swap area and so forth in NVMe is making a huge, huge difference, especially in the world of big data, database and so forth. And so sadly, we don't have anything to show or anything like that. We only have a press release, but this is Padre putting his fingerprints back onto Twyatt because he was twisting some arms for us over at CES. And if all goes well, we're going to have some folks from Kingston on Twyatt to really talk about some of these new NVMe developments and put them into perspective on what it really means. You know, it's not going to be a good fit for everybody, but, you know, who knows? And, you know, maybe we could get someone like Alvin Malventano to talk about the Intel products, because apparently I just been told he's over at Intel now. Who knows? We'll see. The whole bottom line is NVMe is making a massive, massive difference in the server infrastructure out there in the world. And I, for one, want to know a whole bunch more about it.
Fantastic. Well, like Chibert, once in a while I like to talk a little bit about lighter topics like emerging technology that could change the way we do things. Well, this tech is no exception to that rule. It is a paper-thin Bluetooth chip that can operate entirely without a battery. Now, wait a second. Now, that's either cool or scary. Now, how does it work, you ask? Well, this device is a postage stamp size chip from Willett, and it's able to harvest energy from the ambient radio frequencies around us, such as Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, and cellular signals, and use them to power a Bluetooth-equipped ARM processor that can be connected to a variety of sensors. Now, let's think about some of the use cases for this type of technology. It could be embedded in consumer products to provide easy access to digital manual when the original paper version is long lost, or it could be put on clothing as a label used to communicate the optimal settings to a washing machine. In addition to tracking items, though, it could supply in the supply chain. A temperature sensor could also report when items get either too hot or too cold. Now, elsewhere, a pressure sensor could detect when a food container is empty and automatically order a replacement, thereby making so-called smart fridges actually smart. Now, this tech looks to be serious because, well, it actually just received a $30 million financing round from both Amazon and Samsung investors, but they believe there is still another year before their tags become widely available. If nothing else, I hope, hopefully I won't ever lose my keys again with one of these devices. We'll see. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we do, we have to thank a really great sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech, and that is LastPass. Now, who loves LastPass? I do not. I'm going to guess that if I can't see you guys, but I can definitely say that there's probably a bunch of hands raising there. I use LastPass so often, I don't even know I'm using it anymore. It's one of my favorite tools. Now, think about it. You have a username and password for every site you go to. For me, it's 5 different banks. I'm supposed to have a different username and password for each and every site. It becomes almost impossible to remember and manage. And you don't want to have to write those passwords on a sticky note because people can find those things. Or you don't want to send it in an email because in an email, it's plain text and somebody can see it. Now, that's where LastPass comes in and saves us all. LastPass automatically remembers and fills your passwords anytime, anywhere, whether you're on a computer or a mobile device. All you have to do is remember that master password and LastPass remembers the rest. Now, I got hooked on LastPass on my desktop, and now I use it on all my devices. In fact, I use it on all my browsers as well, Chrome, Edge, Firefox, Opera, and more. Plus, it works on all of your mobile devices, both Android and iOS. Now, I can remember the day I actually was at work. My family called me, and they said, hey, we need access to that account so we can make a payment. I didn't remember the username password, but what I did was logged on to LastPass, opened the vault with my master password, and bam, I can give that password to them, and they went ahead and paid the bills. Now, I'm actually talking about my personal accounts here, but LastPass also has LastPass families for the entire family, and it's great for the enterprise too. Enterprises are always battling people trying to breach their networks. Now, check out this piece of data. 81% of breaches are actually caused by weak or reused passwords. Plus, there's a survey shows that 32% of employees share passwords with others. Now, LastPass makes it easy to use using unique random passwords that your employees don't have to remember and write down. LastPass also has the ability to share passwords. And so you don't have to put it on the sticky notes and other places that people can find it. LastPass also makes it easy for your org to actually set password reminders, requirements, restricts access to devices and locations, enable resets, and more. Now, here's a big one. It also offers multi-factor authentication. With LastPass Authenticator, it actually can block attacks by ensuring the identity of the assessor. Now, get this. This will actually raise eyebrows. They also have Active Directory integration. So that means that you don't even have to worry about a separate master password. You could just actually use your Active Directory credentials to log in and get access. Now, for me, that's a pretty big deal, for especially organizations using Active Directory. Now, LastPass Enterprise can configure over 100 policies and access security reports, create shared folders. You can secure a ton of stuff, including organization database logins, SSH keys, licenses, and more. Now, for you actually have easy onboarding. LastPass makes it easy for businesses to take control of their passwords and target, reducing the threat of a breach. Honestly, I love this tool. I need LastPass. I use LastPass. I love it. Over 43,000 businesses from leading tech brands like MailChimp to Fortune 500 companies trust LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager. Find the best password solution for your team at LastPass.com/twit. That's LastPass.com/twit. And we thank LastPass for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. So You may have heard a little bit about the government shutdown that's happening here in the United States since January 1st. Now, whether you agree with it or not, it's definitely creating interesting a job environment for different areas of the industry. One particular facet of the industry is government IT workers. Now, let's look at some of the facts here. All cybersecurity workers at the new Cybersecurity Infrastructure and Security Agency, CISA, that started up in November have been furloughed. 85% of those at a National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, have been furloughed. Little under 50% of Department of Homeland Security intelligence and security teams have been furloughed. 85% of the National Protection and Programs and Directorate, which includes U.S. CERT, which actually means that there will be no alerts about pending cyber attacks and federally sponsored information sharing, have been furloughed. Now, not only that, but there is a trend of contractors also losing their jobs, which I do want to comment about that later. But before we do, like a lot of the other organizations worldwide, numerous positions are held by government contractors. Now, this means that vendors who pay the contractor isn't getting paid. They, too, will have to lay off some of the workforce. Now, what does this mean for the industry? Well, there's quite a bit of need for good professional IT workers, especially ones that understand cyber warfare and cybersecurity. Now, could this opportunity actually open up some opportunity for some of the public organizations to poach some of these professionals out there? Now, if you remember, Amazon HQ2, their headquarters number 2, is actually going to be opening up directly across the Potomac River there from Washington. Now, even though I'm hearing from Amazon, from people who are actually applying to Amazon, they're bait and switching people to where they apply for Virginia and they actually get put into Seattle. But it won't be too long before they start staffing that location as well. Now, Chibert, I want to throw this over to you first because you are an ex-federal cyber worker. How do you feel about what's going on here?
Well, I'll tell you, during my tenure with the federal government, I suffered through, I don't know, 3-4, maybe I think it was 5 federal shutdowns. Most of them have been pretty short. But the sad part is, you know, most IT workers that go to the Fed are looking for some stability. You know, I wanted to go and basically rack up some years so that I could go and have retirement, which would have been awesome. But the real problem is it's a breach of faith. The author of this article is Wayne Rash. Wayne and I have known each other for many, many years. We were both government contractors together working for American Management Systems. And when I was with the Fed, he and I kept in touch. Well, here's the problem. There is a huge, huge shortage in America, or actually across the world, across the Western, the so-called West, UK and so forth. And the reality is I'm starting to hear lots and lots of rumblings on both the private sector and other governments. Like the UK I keep hearing some mumblings from some of my British friends saying, you know, this might be a time when we're going to start seeing lots and lots of people poaching, because there's some really, really upset federal workers, especially as the rumors get louder and louder that maybe some of that back pay isn't going to be paid, and as some federal workers are having trouble meeting their mortgages. This lack of faith with the current administration is probably going to start as a trickle and eventually become a flood. And I'm hearing that we may actually be in a really big way of hurt in the federal government for cyber workers in general, not just cybersecurity workers.
Right. Well, Chris, I want to throw this to you. What do you think? Is this what some of the organizations are thinking? Are they thinking, ooh, fresh meat?
Well, I think especially in security, they almost certainly are, because as we know, there is a very well-documented shortage of good security workers across the entire industry. The estimates of just how many vacancies are there in excess of the people to fill them range from 20,000 to as many as 500,000. Whichever of those numbers you like, it's still a lot. And on the one hand, we've seen the response be raises in the salaries paid to experienced IT security people. On the other hand, a lot of IT security just isn't being done. And unfortunately, we're seeing cases where that's happening in the shutdown. I mean, a very notable example has been certificates, encryption certificates that failed to be renewed. And so there are an awful lot of federal websites that either are unreachable with most current generation web browsers, or when you go there, it throws up a whole bunch of big, nasty warnings. That's just a very small example of what's not happening, but it's indicative of the fact that while all of this is going on, IT security folks are generally not seen as critical personnel and therefore aren't on the job.
Right, right. Now, I want to take an interesting spin on this. Now, I've worked with many different vendors and contractors in the past, and what I noticed is a lot of the contracts that are done are usually done where you pay them quarterly, you pay them, you know, half of the year or so on for, you know, a lump sum, and they're not normally time and materials paid. And so those types of contracts are usually paid ahead of time. So I almost find it interesting that there's been some reports of saying, hey, like there's government contractors out there that are also affected by the shutdown because those companies are already paid, which means they have the money from the government already, which means they can pay their people as they move along. So I'm almost interesting. Cheebert, I want to throw that to you. I mean, is this something that maybe might be an oversight of some of these kind of contracting workers that might have already been paid? They can still work.
Yes and no. It all depends on how creative the agency was. There, shall we say, there used to be, and I believe there still is, a program under the General Services Administration called FAST. And it's especially good for Department of Defense because there was a way to do what's called a MIPR. It's an interagency funds transfer. And it's actually very easy to do. And the cool thing is it's a loophole. And so we actually, when I was there, we only took a 0.5% overhead. Anyway, the point is agencies were able to throw money in that and we were legally allowed to roll to the next fiscal year. I got to imagine some really key players probably took advantage of the MIPR mechanism and used the GSA FAST program or something similar so they can hide some money and keep, you know, key contractors going. I got to imagine not everyone did it. Otherwise, we wouldn't be hearing the amount of hues and cries. But it was a loophole that some agencies use. And it's, you know, as a contracting vehicle, it was very, very successful. And I seriously doubt it's been done away with.
Right, right. Well, hopefully we will soon see the end of the shutdown and hopefully the residual effects won't be too bad. Well, folks, that does it for that bite. Let's go ahead and jump into the next bite. Curtis, you're going to take this one from the helm here. It's about security regulations.
Yeah, this is an interesting one because some recent surveys show that IT decision makers, by a wide margin, would like to see security regulation. Now, you don't often see business people saying they want to see more regulation, but IT professionals are beginning to see government regulation as a last resort to solving their IT security problem. As a matter of fact, in a recent survey that was sponsored by Gemalto, 96% of IT decision makers say that government regulation is necessary if we're going to be secure. Now, they surveyed 950 IT and business decision makers around the world. A third of them say they create Internet of Things devices, 30% create IoT software, 30% are IoT integrators, and half use IoT devices created by a third party. Obviously, multiple responses were allowed in the survey. Now, all of these say that basically we haven't learned anything from all of the breaches that have occurred so far. You have different people putting it in different ways, although they're also saying that they feel that IoT security needs to be handled carefully. Now, just as there are rules about supply chain safety and there are rules about product safety, especially consumer product safety, these executives are saying that there should be ways to protect data. Now, 14% of the people who responded to the survey said that protecting data is an ethical responsibility. There are increases in the way they feel that it's a risk that must be dealt with, as well as a business responsibility. They look at things like brand damage, the consequences of lawsuits, all kinds of other things as being reasons why we need government action to help secure IoT devices. Now, we've already seen in the U.S. states like California beginning to step in on a state-by-state basis, but these executives are saying what they want to see are federal regulations so that basically manufacturers and service providers have one set of regulations to deal with across the entire market. It's interesting. In addition to this, Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, published an op-ed in Time magazine today calling for federal privacy regulation. So I want to turn first, Lewis, to you, because you work with a large company that deals with privacy kind of on a wholesale basis. Do you think that we have reached some sort of tipping point where the businesses that normally would be sort of anti-regulation are saying it's time for us to have one set of rules that we can play by that make our customers feel more secure about what we're doing?
Right. I think, like, personally, I think that from my standpoint, a little bit of regulation around holding organizations accountable for not securing data is actually one way to help this out. I think regulating on the type of security, you know, and the way of doing security might be actually a bad thing, because that'll actually force people to use specific technologies and eventually those will be exploited and then we'll be in trouble. So I definitely think that there should be some more regulation around the kind of what, you know, how organizations are held accountable for these types of things. I definitely think that will help. But again, I think, you know, it all depends. I mean, most organizations, they should do the right thing, because most companies are looking for their for consumers and organizations to trust them. In order to do that, they have to have good ethical data and regulations and so on. So I think that, you know, I think this will definitely push more organizations to think about it more, advertise it more, do it more. Does government need to be involved? Possibly, possibly not. If it does, I think it definitely needs to move in that direction of holding accountability. But that's kind of my point of view there.
Well, in terms of holding organizations responsible, Brian, I'd like to turn over to you. To what extent do you trust government agencies and especially Congress to be able to get it right when it comes to finding a balance between protecting personal data and not actively stifling the innovation that we depend on?
Well, having been in that environment, I don't like it, only because when Congress gets involved, they tend to use a sledgehammer to pound in a 10-penny nail. It tends to go too far. I would love to see industry actually police themselves. I would love to see us actually get to the point where we can actually trust our security devices. I'm looking at it from a consumer standpoint and seeing a lot of students, my faculty, staff, people just buying these cheapy little routers. I'm not going to name brands, but we all know what they are. And they're running such ancient versions of the Linux kernel that they're about as secure as wet tissue paper. I would love to see something drive it, you know, maybe in from an industry area. Like, for instance, I'm actually taking a good hard look at, you know, if we are going to ever get to the point where we can, you know, control rooftop solar and actually have widespread rooftop solar adoption, then we're going to have some sort of security so we can trust the links from the residential controllers up to the utilities. And that's going to take more serious security, not this tissue paper type of thing. And so I really and truly want to see something happen, but I'm not sure I want the federal government to go and start hammering in, you know, tiny nails with big sledgehammers.
Well, tiny nails with big sledgehammers is one of the things that government does best. I think the real question for a lot of industry is, if not the government, who? And I'm also hearing people say that, especially with the advent of GDPR in Europe, the idea of a single sort of flavor of privacy control across these two very large markets, Europe and North America, would make many of the vendors much more comfortable. Well, this is one we're going to work for a long time, one that we're going to be talking about certainly in the future. But for the moment, it's time to go back to our host, Louis Maresca, for his take.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, Curtis. Yes, I think we definitely going to have some more regulations for sure, and GDPR for sure is going to help with that. Now, whether we need that in the country or not, we'll have to see. Hopefully organizations will start taking accountability themselves, but we'll have to see for sure. Well, folks, that does it for the Bites. Next up, we get to bring a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twiat Riot. But before we do, we have to thank another sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Slack. Now, if you haven't used Slack before, it literally is the collaboration hub for you. Your work or whatever you want to do, you can bring together pretty much anybody with Slack. And there are so many ways I've used Slack before. It allows me to bring together numerous groups in order to just organize the way we work. Now, I've used it to actually talk between large corporations, whether it's those large cloud organizations that I'm collaborating with or just collaborating with customers. And I've seen actually IT and operations teams, as well as engineering and development groups, brought together into one set of channels that let everyone organize the conversations with real-time messaging. And there are a ton of features on top of just real-time messaging. There's also video and voice calling, as well as file sharing. It also provides an unstoppable set of features to ensure productivity. Now, why use email? Save time. Go back and search those, gain historical context from the discussions from those different groups and teams and topics on Slack. Now, Slack brings a rich environment for keeping people up to date and create new channels, new issues, show alerts for real-time updates in the channel. But also, you can also integrate your favorite system so you can bring the information to you. Now, get data from Jira, Salesforce, Zendesk, Google Drive, and just hook up those webhooks to get more information. It's literally the collaboration hub. Slack keeps teams together, ensures they're communicating efficiently and staying productive every step of the way. Now, imagine your sales team. They're getting together. They're talking about new products, learning about these new products, talking about different prospects or even current clients. Well, you missed that meeting. Well, you actually go back, load Slack up, creates a place where you can learn that historical context, look at all the notes, look at all the discussions, check out. It's really that place where you can find everything you need, search through the historical context, get what you need. Now, I've used in the Slack in the past. In fact, I've used a really great feature called Slack Threads, which actually lets you kind of take the conversation off onto a tangent if you want. It doesn't interrupt the actual thread. You can have additional conversations off to the side, which is kind of a cool feature. Plus, they have really great searching, advanced searching capabilities where you can have different search modifiers. You can search in different channels, different times, from different people. Really creates a really great way to find the information you need. Now, people of many generations have used Slack, including I've seen actually people plan reunions, handle different facets of events, support products, even help their sales team. Slack really makes it easier. In fact, there's really a great place. You have over 1,000 apps you can integrate and use with Slack. So go out, check it right now and see what you can do with Slack. Slack reduces your emails, streamlines your communication, saves time, and increases your productivity. I can't say enough good things about Slack. With Slack, your team is better connected. Learn more at slack.com. That's slack.com. And we thank Slack for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it now brings that time of the show, that really my favorite part of the show. We get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twiat Riot. And today we have Richard Black, founder and CEO of Secure Channels. Richard, welcome to the show.
All right. Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate being here.
Absolutely. So our audience loves to hear origin stories, people's journeys through tech. Maybe take the audience through how you got started in tech and how you actually got to Secure Channel.
Great. Look, I'm a technologist in the way from an entrepreneurial perspective. Sure, it's an investment, but I really have a passion for technology. It's exciting. I like that I can get into something and, you know, with the mentality of if you think it, we can build it. And there's not a lot of other industries that you can actually do that. So always having that innovative mindset and being able to look at technology in that way and then look at the landscape that where technology actually can enable and fix a lot of things. Several years ago, I invested in a company that was early stage certification authority and public key management. And I got involved with an inventor that used to work at Microsoft that had some ideas around some encryption primitives. And then years passed and we kept going on. And then all of a sudden the Snowden event or the revelations came out. And that really raised awareness about what could be going on with our own government and other mass surveillance. So with that, Secure Channel was kind of founded on the premise of, hey, you know, there's a lot of different opportunities to or possibilities to protect data out there. And the main method, at least the standard for encrypting data is AES, but AES does have that target on its back. It's excellent at what it does, and it's been improved through efficiency as time goes on. However, it does have that target on the back because it is the only one out there that is the main one people are using. So eventually, as time passes, compute power goes up, whether it's supercomputer or as we get into the quantum age, there should be ways to look at strengthening encryption as we go forward. And that's kind of where Secure Channels came in from its focal point of initially developing an encryption algorithm that used those building blocks within AES and strengthening and coming up with a mode of operation that would actually strengthen AES going and thinking for the future.
Right. So I know we have a lot of topics that we do want to talk a little bit about that as well, but I want to get into one topic and get your point of view here. Sure. Now, governments around the world don't seem to be too happy with data security. From that angle, they don't like data encryption. Now, we had talked about in our previous episodes about the Australian government just recently passing some laws around making sure that organizations have back doors into their systems so they can access data. Now, you actually wrote an article about this. Can we maybe walk us through what's happening in around the world here?
Well, I mean, of course, governments want to surveil. I mean, that's no matter what they say on a political, in the front end of political, and on the back end, they want to have all kinds of information on its citizens, whichever government. We can name any government. I don't think there's a government out there that doesn't would not like to have access to personal information for all sorts of reasons, monetary and otherwise. And Australia, that, you know, is they're putting the face, the window dressing on law enforcement and for other reasons, because they think encryption is a barrier. But that is just nonsense. Anybody that knows anything about technology knows that if you weaken a security primitive somewhere that and create this so-called backdoor, that it's also going to be there for the bad guys. You can't do something in code, binary, that works for the good guys only and not for the bad guys. So it's nonsensical all the way across the board, and I'm adamantly opposed to the Australian approach, and we are as a company.
Right. Makes sense. Now, I've actually seen some demos of some of your products. There's some really cool stuff there, especially I've looked at the Paradox Box, where you actually can create a container and then secure it with MFA and make sure it's encrypted. And you have a laundry list of different encryption algorithms you can use and ways to identify the user. Can you tell us a little bit about that product and how it helps consumers and organizations alike?
Yeah, so the Paradox Box, you know, we really developed to, you know, reach the endpoint but have enterprise administrative controls. So that's the good thing about it. is that it is adaptable to Active Directory. The IT administrator or whoever the administrator is can turn on and turn off workstations at the endpoint. And it's another method of assuring authenticity assurance for the users because of the way everything is registered and the multi-factor authentication that is involved there. And then the administrator has some choices of different encryption algorithms to use. AES is part of it. It's an 8 algorithm suite so far, and it's being readied for Quantum. So as a SaaS model, it's always updating with various improvements, embellishments, and patches as we move down the development path with that. But I mean, the ability to be able to create these containers that are going to be at the volume level, file level, partition level, and even have a hidden volume that would be have a secondary access through a secondary authentication, make it a very interesting and robust product for both your encryption, data security, and data management.
Right. So this, I've actually saw the demo that I saw. You actually had a pretty unique way of identifying that the user, their multi-factor there. Can you tell us a little bit about like this particular method and how it's actually helping Paradox Box actually be more secure?
Yeah. So it's a machine inheritance. It's also a what you know inheritance without using a traditional password. That is called SBROSA, which is actually an acronym, simple user base, resource oriented segmentation architecture. And what that allows the user to do is select from an image portfolio, your own images or stock images, and you then select segments of an image, and it's actually resource-based. We happen to be using images. It could be any binary resource. It could also be a WAV file. It could be a video file. It could be a document. And it's something you'll remember, something you know. So your own images, you were on your vacation. You'll know the order of events that happened in your vacation, for example. And so you can select 2 or 3 or 4, 6, 7, whatever segments from an image, an area on a quadrant. There'll be a grid, and you'll select certain segment images as your password. So while you're selecting 4, 5, 6 image segments, what happens from there is due to the binary pixelation from each of those segments, a cryptographic, very strong cryptographic key is created from that. So with 4 image segments, about a 65,000 character cryptographic key is generated from that. So the hacker or attacker would have to deal with that, not the image segments that were taken. So it's a very novel approach that is a little bit gamified, and users seem to enjoy that quite a bit.
Very cool. Now, one of the choices of encryption I noticed is this new pattern key multi-segment and multi-standard encryption, or PKMS2. Now, this thing is pretty strong. It basically corrects a lot of the issues that you were talking about, where kind of AES kind of has a target on its back. And it things resistance to known message recovery attacks and so on and so forth. Now, Paradox Box offers this now. Is this just another way to help organizations ensure that their data won't be kind of leaked out and broken? Like how strong is this thing?
Yeah, that's a great question. So correct, it's a mode of operation, so it's a choice. So it's a layered and segmented approach to encryption. So it still will be able to use the building blocks that are with AES. In fact, AES is part of it, but there are other, it's like a sandwich, AES on top, AES at the end. And in the middle, there will be several other encryption algorithms that are used that are segmented and layered. And it's maintained by its design with efficiency. So the overhead is negligible in comparison to ACS, AES in GCM mode, for example. And beyond the security guarantees, the bit strength is actually at a minimum 387 bit, and we in certain circumstances it's up to 512. So that's allowing for future proofing, as I mentioned previously.
Fantastic. Well, my co-hosts are chomping at the bit here in the chat, in the back chat that we have here. So I want to actually bring them back in. Cheebert, I want to throw this over to you first because you had some questions about volume.
Well, actually, I want to ask a question for you know, some of our managers and people out there that maybe don't understand the nuts and bolts of encryption. Windows and Macs both have an encrypted volume option. But Paradox Box sounds very, very different. For our newer users, could you compare and contrast them why a Paradox Box would make more sense?
Well, it's just much, it's much more robust. I mean, and it's also controlled by the administrator in an enterprise or large organization. It also allows you to do more than just volume encryption. You can encrypt a single file. You can share it within the org, out of the org. So that is interesting. It's also quite fast. You know, the Windows and Apple solution, I don't want to say are sluggish, but they're not the most speedy methods to go about. So there's also the issue of while there is, for example, with BitLocker, you know, that's great when, and it works with BitLocker too, by the way. But in the case of BitLocker, it's great for a laptop that you leave in the back of your car and the laptop's stolen, the laptop is off. However, we're speaking about the time while you're working and operating and you need that security. BitLocker is not effective then. And the use of Paradox Box in real-time use where you're transferring files and encrypting and actually working doesn't have an effect on other system applications that are going on. And in the case of Apple and the Microsoft volume encryption, there is an effect there. So I would say that's a very distinct separator.
So I know that Curtis actually wanted to ask a little bit about containers.
Sure.
Yeah, you mentioned containers, and while security is one of those things that is often touted when people are looking at a container deployment mechanism, I'm curious because there can be some issues around separation with all of that shared resource pool that containers draw on. Separating one process from another or even one customer from another can be tricky. How do you do that and assure people that everyone has their very own set of resources here when it comes to your security?
Well, that's another good question. So if you're going to have others participate in the sharing of data items, files, or whatever that may be, you do have to take steps to ensure security. So whether that is registering at the SaaS portal or going through means of authentication when you're going to share instead of it just being out there in the public, you do have to make those steps necessary to prove you are who you are. In essence, the Bob is Bob, Alice is Alice scenario, you want to take those steps and measures because I, as the owner of a data set, want to know and have assurance that it is going to a recipient and know that they are going to actually be the ones viewing it, receiving it, and handling it. So it's all about really implementation and design. It's not all just on how the technology works. You have to design and implement in accordance with those kinds of thoughts in mind on how it's going to be used and how you're going to manage your data security.
Right. So I do want to shift really quick to another one of the products that I saw from Secure Channels, because, you know, email is one of those things nowadays. Everyone uses it. It's big in organizations, and it's been tough to kind of secure email lately. You can have a key that kind of encrypts things, but it's been known to be broken many times. So email's a direct target going forward. How is Secure Channels helping with this?
Yeah, great. Thank you for that. We're very excited about XFA Mail, which is our implementation in as an Outlook plugin right now. We're right now developing and will soon be released for both mobile for both iOS and Android. And we will have this as an 0365 Gmail and any other public email, Pop email as well. But what we're very excited about the XFA Mail is that it's a non-PKI implementation. And most of the complaints we hear out there that are other users of encrypted type of mail, and this is secure email, it's not just about encryption, is the complications in dealing with certificates and getting others involved in the email communication. So what we did here is we've used a non-PKI method, which is leveraging for this purpose the Amazon Web Services satellite, global satellite reach that they have. And we've developed an exchange of an elaborate method of token exchange, token as in GUIDs and tokens, not the cryptocurrency type of tokens, that at initiation, and this all happens simultaneously, assure that, again, in that scenario, Bob is Bob and Alice is Alice. So what will happen is when you're going to get the plugin, you're going to register, you're going to prove your identity through the registration process with your device, with yourself. And in order for a recipient to get the email, they will have to do the same. Now, what we where we really change and get unique, besides the back end with the key exchange process, is that when I send an encrypted email, I'm also using a second factor. So I've already registered, but one of the things I registered with is my facial recognition with a very sophisticated and very fine-tuned facial recognition. And we store none of the emails, we store none of the keys, and we store none of the biometric data. That's all done with either Microsoft or Amazon Web Services. So when I go to encrypt an email, it immediately activates the camera and it verifies that I am who I'm supposed to be, and then the email is sent. When the recipient, or Alice in this case, receives the email, in order to decrypt it, you can click on it and it will still be encrypted in your inbox, whether it's phone or your desktop. When you double click, you will activate the camera and it will verify that it is the recipient before it decrypts. If someone else is in the picture, like you're offline, this can be offline too. So you're on the aircraft, you're traveling, and there's someone peering through the seat watching you open your email, that email will not decrypt if it senses another face in the view of the camera. That's how tuned it is. And of course, there's options of tuning in and out of that. But the point is adding that factor of authentication with facial recognition and or other biometrics. This is just, again, the most easiest and the most adaptable. Then you really are getting assurance that that communication chain between Bob and Alice is certain, and you know when you're sending a secure email that is to be read by one person or more if you put them in the chain, that they are the authenticated recipients.
You know, Richard, this sounds absolutely amazing, but I got to ask for our viewers, you know, what kind of charge model do we have? You know, is it on a per seat, per use? What happens if I just want to exchange really secure email between my PDA and my buddy's PDA in Germany? You know, what kind of money am I looking at? Is it for big companies, medium companies, or can mom and pop use it too?
We are actually launching a SaaS portal called SkiffCom, which is where you would go up and make that registration. So think of that as the token authority. So we have a free version for that will be consumer, that will be for a certain amount of emails or messages sent. You don't actually pay for the plugin. You will register. There'll be a credit card, and depending on the amount that you're going to use, it's a nominal monthly amount of $4, $6 to $7 a month. And that's about it. I mean, that's all the cost that's involved in that. And there is a free version that has some limitations, but not in security for that scenario that you just mentioned.
Well, and I'm assuming from the free version up to, say, a large enterprise, it's all scalable, right?
Correct. Absolutely.
Fabulous. Thank you.
Sure.
So one question for me is that you said that they're working on a plugin for Outlook, and then it's moving to Android and iOS. Now, are these like standalone applications? Do I have to switch from my mail app that I'm using on iOS now and then kind of switch to the secure channel version, or is it actually work with some of the email apps that are out there as well?
So obviously the plugin on desktop is Outlook. So that is, you're using Outlook. The same will be for when you use O365. Now on the phone itself, we've modeled the email app to be exactly like the iPhone inherent one, as the same as Android. But in order to put the encryption and all the security measures in the application, we had to make our own app for the mobile versions.
That makes sense. Now, you said that you're actually rolling out a free version. Is there a timeline for that, or is it already kind of coming out?
It will be out by RSA.
Fantastic.
Which is March, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Fantastic. Well, we're running a little bit low on time. Thank you so much for being here, Richard. We wanted to give you a chance to tell the folks at home where they can find all of the work that's being done by Secure Channels, as well as where they can get started. How can an organization say, hey, I want to get started with some of these new features? Where do I go? What do I do? Who do I contact? That kind of thing.
Great. I mean, they can. Anybody can reach me. Everything is available on our website as far as information. That's securechannels.com. They can reach through contact, or as you see there on the screen, or I think we have all our information on there, including the telephone number. We're very adaptable, agile. You know, things are not just cookie cutter that this is the way it is. We're really an engineering minded firm, so we're able to adapt most of our agnostic based technologies anyways to fit into your environment rather than the other way around.
Fantastic. Well, folks, you have done it again. You sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe, according to 9 out of 10 SHA-256 hashes. But I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host in crime, the brains of the outfit, starting with Mr. Brian Chi, our producer, and one of our co-hosts here. Chibert, where can the folks find you and all of your work?
Oh, I love Twitter. I'm ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. Or you can toss me an email. I'm chibert@twit.tv. Or better yet, why don't you use twit@twit.tv? And that way the email will hit all the hosts. Looking forward to hearing your ideas. Padre, you know, good old Padre, his fingerprints are all over this show, sent me a long list of people to go in contact for potential guests. And I've also gotten a few emails from people. I am desperately trying to find someone to talk about network inventory. That was one of the hot buttons from our viewers. And we shall see what we shall see, shall we?
Fantastic, Jeebert. Well, I feel more informed, especially when the great Mr. Curtis Franklin keeps us informed. Curtis, can you tell the folks at home where they can find you and all of your great work?
Well, as always, you can find my writing at darkreading.com, and you can find out when I'm writing and what I'm writing if you follow me on Twitter at KG4GWA. As I said, I'm getting ready for RSA. My mailbox is filling up, as is my dance card for the conference. So if you would like to see me out in San Francisco at RSA, drop me a direct message on Twitter, or drop me a note at curtis.franklin@ubm.com. I will look forward to getting those and to seeing the Twiat Riot out in the real world.
Fantastic. Well, also thanks to you as well. You are our loyal listeners and watchers. You come in each and every week to get your enterprise goodness. And we want to make it easy for you to watch and listen onto the show. Now, you go out right now to twit.tv/Twiat, and there you'll find all of our amazing back episodes, our show notes, co-host information, especially our guest information, links to all the links to all the stories that we do during the show. Especially more importantly, next to those videos there, they have those great helpful subscribe links. Subscribe to your audio version, video version, HD video version of your choice, and listen on any one of your devices. It's the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news. Now, after you subscribe, share it with your friends, because we want to keep doing this show, and we can keep doing it with your support and their support as well. Now, after you subscribe, also remember we do the show live each and every week at live.twit.tv at 1:30 p.m. Pacific. On Fridays, to come see how the show is run, the behind the scenes, and all the things that we talk about. Now, if you're going to jump in live, you might as well jump into that chat room live as well, irc.twit.tv. We have some great people in there. They're always asking great questions, starting discussions. So go ahead and jump in there and join the show. Always also don't forget to follow me on twitter.com/LouMM. Also, you can see all of my work that I do at Microsoft at dev.office.com, where we talk about all the latest and greatest ways to customize Office and your experience and how to make it more productive. Now, I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa, who continue to support us each and every week doing This Week in Enterprise Tech. Also, thank you to our loyal producer, Brian Chi, who also gets all the bookings and plannings for the show. Thanks to him for helping us and continuing to support This Week in Enterprise Tech. And also, I want to thank our TD before we sign out here, Victor. Victor, I know we want to continue this tradition because I think you could definitely get it this time. What was the main topic of the show today?
Well, it's almost lunchtime here, so I was like thinking encryption sandwiches.
You know, so close. No, so close. I think we may almost give you that one today because it was definitely about data protection. So we'll give you that one for once. So that's a New Year's tradition. We'll start something new here. We'll give it to you this time.
I'll take it.
All right. Sounds good. All right. Well, until next time, I'm Louis Moresca saying, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.